Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I thought, what would be better than to use my 34 years in the veterinary industry than to help you guys, the pet owner? What are your questions? What do you need to know? What would you like to know? I want to create a completely interactive podcast where you, the listener, can ask your questions and we will answer them. I will have industry-leading professionals come in and have conversations about your very questions. What keeps you up at night? What worries you about your pet? What worries you about the cost of taking care of your animal? There's so many things that we can talk about, but I need you to tell me what we need to come up with. Because if you do that, we can have a great, great, great session.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Tales. I am here with Dr. G, as usual, and today our special guest is Dr. Justin Greco. G, I will let you introduce Dr. Greco.
Hello, Dr. Greco.
Hello, Dr. G.
He is a board-certified veterinary surgeon. Did mobile practice, is how I got to know him. He used to go to regular general practices and do surgeries just so clients didn't have to pay so much to go to a specialties. And then he started a brick and mortar. But I think he's kind of dabbling back a little bit into the mobile. Yeah. So we're very lucky to have him.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. We're super excited to have you. We have a bunch of questions from our viewers for you. And we just like to remind everybody, while we love discussing animal health and pet care, this podcast represents only the opinion of these two guys. We are not diagnosing, treating, or providing medical advice for your individual pet. So to dive into this, my first question for you is going to be about your mobile vet care. I think when most people think of mobile vet care, they assume you're going to their house. You do a slightly different version of mobile vet care. What is that?
Yeah, so I mean, mobile veterinary surgery is rarely going to someone's house because you obviously need an OR and recovery and a lot of equipment. So, you know, routine care. I know some people do mobile surgery, but we're doing some big orthopedic stuff. You need a lot of equipment. So I go to practices.
So you're mobile that you travel from clinic to clinic.
Correct. Yes. So yeah, I only do surgery at veterinary practices. Yeah. Where there's obviously an OR and they recover them and all that stuff. Yeah.
Which is a great option for pet owners.
Yeah.
Because you get to get everything done at the clinic that you know and trust.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it takes a lot of that stress off of the whole relationship between client and veterinarian. Because a lot of these specialty hospitals you referred to, you don't know who they are. You just know your doctor referred you there. But you still don't have that intimate relationship you usually have with your veterinarian.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have that familiarity. And typically it's going to be significantly less expensive as well, which is, you know, that's less so nowadays. When I first started doing it about 7 years ago, it was absolutely the case. And
yeah.
People were saving thousands and thousands of money, dollars of, you know, for these procedures and staying in the comfort of their regular veterinarian.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people know that you can still get a board certified surgeon to do a surgery at your general practice, mm-hmm. versus having to go to specialty, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, depends on where you are. You know, here there's a fair number of them. You go some other places and there's a lot less. So it just depends on, you know, here we're pretty rich with veterinary specialists.
Yeah.
But yeah, other places are less so. But yeah, it's a good option for the right clinic and the right case. You know, you have to be careful with what you're doing with that setup for sure.
Yeah.
I think pet owners need to ask their veterinarian, is there any chance you could get a boarded surgeon to come in here to do the surgery?
Yeah. Right.
Because I don't think a lot of veterinarians know that option exists.
Yeah, I think it depends. You know, the practice owners are typically very well aware of it because, you know, financially it makes a lot more sense as a practice owner to keep the case there if appropriate.
Right.
Associates, especially younger associates where they don't have that mindset, that yes, I think you're right, Dr. G, they're less aware of that as an option for sure.
What are the big pros for you? I know we kind of talked on financially. The other one is, you know, having your vets that you trust be around. Do you think there's other pros to having it done at being mobile and getting a surgery done?
Mainly logistics, you know, comfort, cost would be the big ones.
Yeah.
There's some cons too, obviously. I don't know if you want me to talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the main con would be, you know, typically no overnight care.
Right.
So overnight care can be very difficult or non-existent. And for some cases, it's okay. Other cases, I would argue it's malpractice. Other cases, it's kind of in the gray area. Kind of like, well, it could be fine, but could run into trouble. And so it really just depends on the case, the comfort level of the client, comfort level of the veterinarian, et cetera. And then facility-wise, it's a grab bag of facilities, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I've done major orthopedic surgery in a broom closet, and I've done major orthopedic surgery in big, beautiful OR suites that you'd think is in a human hospital. So, and everything in between.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, you have to pick your cases and locations for, you know, this may not be appropriate for this type of case, or, you know, appropriate for a different type of case. But facility is a very big difference from a specialty hospital to a GP in terms of OR, monitoring equipment, again, overnight care, even just post-operative care.
Yeah, or even just different pain different medications that they offer.
Yeah. So, you know, for some cases, I think it is worth the extra money and the inconvenience and the lack of familiarity. I think it's worth it for some cases to go somewhere where they have different facilities and, you know, they're set up for doing more advanced procedures. You know, so like a chest case, you know, in a chest tube afterwards, and, you know, those things can be pretty dicey. And yeah, can they do okay at a general day practice? Yeah, but if something goes wrong, you're kind of in trouble. So, you know, again, it's about case selection, which I learned painfully as I started doing it, you know, years back.
Yeah.
Kind of what to be careful of and what's fine. I mean, the classic is just the elective orthopedic case, right? Happy, healthy Labrador tore ACL. That's the classic mobile surgeon bread and butter, which,
yeah,
you know, 99% of the time they do great.
Yeah. So. Are you traveling in with your own staff or using the hospital staff?
So, you know, everyone does it a little differently, but I always travel with, you know, at least probably now two technicians, because they know how I do things, where all my stuff is.
Right.
They help monitor, you know, the anesthesia and all that stuff. So the more consistency you can get in an inconsistent situation, the better for me. So you try to control what you can control.
Yeah.
So every variable that I could control, being a mobile veterinary surgeon, I would control that variable. Some things you can't.
Yeah.
But the things you can, you do it.
Are you using your own protocols or are you using the hospital's protocols as far as
like the anesthetic protocols? Typically they for first time, first couple times, they say, what do you like? You know, and I say, well, you know, and I kind of give them recommendations, and then it's usually just kind of the same every time after that. Yeah.
Nice.
The great thing is also, I want to ask Dr. Greco, what's your opinion about the importance of post-operative or actually pre-operative and post-operative pain control?
I mean, obviously very important. You know, back in the day, veterinary surgeons and human surgeons, for that matter, would use pain as a way to control activity. We've kind of gotten away from that a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, pain control and pain, we've found, does a lot of things, you know, bad things physiologically. We just don't want to see our, you know, beloved pet in pain, obviously. So we try to do everything we can. And You know, the wind-up mechanism, you know, so preoperative pain control is really important. It's also very important for anesthetic, you know, smoothness.
Yeah.
You know, if they're feeling everything you're doing in surgery, it's going to be a lot more difficult to keep them under anesthesia, and you're going to have to blast them with inhalant, their pressure's tank, and then, you know, and then you're blasting with fluids, and it's a roller coaster. So pain control in that regard is very important, too, but obviously also for the pain itself. And, you know, honestly, for most orthopedics, you don't want them doing nothing. That's actually counterproductive. I mean, again, back in the day, it's like, don't use the leg for 4 weeks. You know, it's like, no, you want them. I tell my clients, you know, when I see them at my practice, when I can actually talk to the clients, I say, no, I want them using the leg the day after surgery, not running and jumping and playing on it, but walking on it. And
we need
early,
some type of toe tapping, some type of movement going.
And that's beneficial. It actually stimulates bone healing, like for TPLOs, so Wolf's Law, you know, use it or lose it, basically stimulates bone healing, helps with joint flexibility, comfort, strength, et cetera. So, you know, early return to function is really imperative, and pain control is a huge part of that, of course. I'll just go back real quick. One of the other negatives, and I've run into this doing both now, one of the big negatives of the mobile surgery is you can't speak typically to the surgeon.
Right.
So preoperatively, postoperatively, the most typically you'll get is a phone call afterwards from the surgeon saying, yeah, everything went great, good luck. And then the rest is on the GP. So that's a huge negative typically. It doesn't have to be a huge negative if you have someone that's really that really knows their stuff and is a really good communicator, like this guy here, like Dr. G, handled it. You know, he's great with communicating. He gets it. He knows what you need to do and what to look for, etc. Some, especially younger veterinarians, you know, they don't. They're maybe not great communicators. I know I wasn't when I first started. And if people don't feel like they're getting adequate communication, that's when stress goes through the roof. People start getting angry.
Yeah.
If there's any little problem, doesn't even have to be a big problem. If they don't feel like that problem's addressed properly, and they get really upset, and I don't blame them. And it can be really difficult if you don't know, if you don't have the confidence, someone like seasoned like Dr. G, where I don't know, I need to check with the surgeon if that's okay.
Right.
And then it takes a week for the surgeon to get back to them, and the client the whole time's fuming.
Yeah.
Like, is it okay or not?
Right.
Like, well, he hasn't called me back yet. You know, it's not like I would do that. I would try to get back to people as soon as possible. But it's a lot more delayed in terms of getting people's concerns addressed. And even the surgeries that go perfectly and there's no complications at all, most people, especially really intense, specialty level type clients, they'll find something to ask you about.
Oh, yeah.
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 As you guys know.
Yeah. It never fails. I mean, we used to bring you into our clinic. So like you said, it's... I think it's kind of trusting the clinic you're working with.
Absolutely.
That's part of...
To do the right thing when they're done.
It's
right.
Yep, absolutely. And know when to just deal with it or when to get me involved.
Right.
Like, hey,
going to ask you, do you think most post-operative complications come from when there's a lack of communication between pen owner or clinic? Both sides guilty.
I think it happened... Most complications happen because the client doesn't listen, whether it's... they're told by the GP or the surgeon or whatever. But it's much more likely for them not to get adequate communication about post-op care in the mobile situation. Because again, you're relying on that GP knowing what the heck they're talking about. I would always, you know, like I give you guys the discharge template. I don't know if you use it or not.
Yeah.
But that's a starting point where it's okay. It's all printed out there. But I've had clinics where I know what they do is they literally hand the discharge. They read that at home.
Oh yeah, no.
And I'm sure you guys didn't do that, but a lot of them did because they're busy. They didn't have time. It's like, let us know if you have any questions. Whereas, you know, at my clinic, we sit down and literally go line by line through it, which is probably what you guys would do. So again, that another variable that I didn't really have a lot of control over. And if it was really bad, then I just wouldn't go to that clinic.
So take home message is if you have any questions at all or confused in any way, before you leave the clinic, you ask those questions. And even when you get home, if you have questions reading it over, write them down, email them back, call in.
Yeah.
Usually emails were the best for us because it's hard to pick up the phone doing everything. If you send an email, we'll make your clinic should make sure they get those questions answered.
And a lot of clinics have texting now too, which, you know, so even if it's like a quick question and you just want to kind of rapid fire your questions, I mean, at least your questions are – noted somewhere, right? To at least get someone get back to you.
Texting is great, you know, versus getting a phone, you know, a voicemail.
And yeah.
You know, like, okay, now I got to listen to a call. You know, just it's a lot more difficult to do.
Yeah. Do you think when pet owners are getting their discharge instructions, just maybe advice for people picking their pets up from surgery, to do it when their pet is not in front of them, so they're actually like focused and paying attention to the instructions?
Absolutely. So
100%.
Yes.
Yeah.
We
weren't allowed to bring the animals up until our discharge was done because you see that disconnect.
Their brains turn off. Mine would too if my Labrador got after surgery. I'm seeing him for the first time since they had surgery.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not listening to anybody anymore. I'm looking
at your guy.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So absolutely do not, wait. And you know, I guess this is geared towards the, you know, the pet owner client. Don't think like, just give me my dog.
It's like, right.
It's for a reason. So
there's a method to the madness.
Yeah, so you're not distracted when we're going over these things that are going to be important, you know, for maximizing a good outcome.
Yeah.
For sure.
And Dr. Gassel made a comment when he was here the other day that I just want to see if you agree with or not, that the surgery is the easy part. It's the recovery at home and the post-op care is really what makes these cases a little bit more difficult, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, it depends on the surgery,
yeah,
at least.
I guess,
for
right?
me, anyway. but for, like, the routine stuff, you know, that you've done tens of thousands of, like, you know, TPLOs, which I'm sure he's at those numbers, too. Yeah, those are very routine and usually go very, very well. And the reason why they don't do well is because of poor compliance with what we're supposed to be doing. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
All right. We have a few more. We have some more questions for soft tissue. Are there minimally invasive options for soft tissue surgeries?
That's a very broad. So soft tissue surgery entails a lot of obviously different categories.
Right. I would say maybe if we stick along the lines of
spay.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So for abdominal procedures, right now, what's available that's being done fairly routinely, like at a specialty level, would be laparoscopic. That means with a laparoscope or a camera in the abdomen, we insufflate with CO2. So insufflate just means fill it with a gas so you can have working space. And you have a camera and some instrument ports in there. And fairly routinely now, laparoscopic cholecystectomies, which is one of the most common minimally invasive procedures in people. So that's removing the gallbladder. So that, for people that do that for a living, you know, they do that all the time. So laparoscopic cholecystectomies, laparoscopic assisted gastropexies, splenectomies, assisted even GI-form bodies, intestinal RNAs, those can all be laparoscopic assisted. And then, of course, spays.
Yeah.
Laparoscopic assisted cystotomies. So all of those can be done for sure. The difficulty is, let's say you have a big splenic tumor or something. It's really, you know, so you have these little tiny incisions in the abdominal wall. And you have a beach ball splenic tumor. Like, you got to get that out some way.
Right.
So you can't get that out minimally invasively unless.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
You use what's called a morselizer. So,
geez.
It's exactly what it sounds like, I imagine.
So
you basically, you know, you make a smoothie out of the spleen. And usually you contain it in a bag and then you either can pull the bag out or you suck that out. That's the only way to get out a beach ball mass,
right?
Minimally invasively.
But then you lose your chances to do a lot of stuff with it. postoperatively, right? If you want to, for diagnosis.
Cheesecloth. So yeah. you basically constrain the smoothie and try to get a biopsy that way. You can try to get preemptive biopsies before you make the smoothie.
Right.
I know that's really gross. Maybe I should stop saying that. Yeah.
So if someone wants to do a laparoscopic spay, what's the difference in time between doing a routine, no spay is a routine, but an abdominal spay versus a laparoscopic spay?
So, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm always qualifying these answers, but it depends on the patient. Obviously, a 120-pound dog versus a 20-pound. But all things being equal, it really boils down to experience level. Like you doing a spay, you probably could do those in like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Whereas someone maybe 5 years out, couple years out, I've seen them take literally 3 hours to do a large dog spay, right?
Yeah.
And the same goes kind of with you could be really good at the routine, conventional spay, but once you start doing laparoscopic, it's a whole nother ball game, and that learning curve is fairly steep.
Right.
Because now you're doing IHANS screen, and it's a pretty steep learning curve. I used to do a lot of arthroscopy, which is, just in joints, and it's the same idea. It's just, it's an interesting skill, to learn. It's really fun, but it can be very frustrating. And so, obviously, when you're in that steep part of the learning curve, it can take you some time.
It's like playing a video game, though.
Which I used to always tell my mom, because there's studies saying that the more video games you play, the better you are at scoping.
Oh, there you go.
So it's a great excuse to, if you're a high schooler or something, it's like, see, mom, I'm
practicing to be a surgeon.
Exactly.
Do you notice a difference in the recovery time? Because I think that's people's like big idea, mm-hmm. right? Is that a smaller incision, less pain, but incisions heal side to side, right? Not top to bottom. So,
yeah. So, I mean, side to side lengthwise, that's kind of healing rate. That's not necessarily pain. So that's
true.
Like, okay, it's going to heal the same, same time period.
Right.
In terms of pain, that is determined by the amount of tissue that's been damaged.
Okay.
So kind of volume of tissue, because it's inflammation is the healing process, and inflammation equals pain. So the longer the incision, theoretically, the more pain you're going to feel. It's very difficult, especially in animals, but people too, to do pain studies. It's very difficult. There's a lot of variables. They've put little motion monitors on these dogs. And I know one paper, I think a friend of mine did a while back, where the dogs that had the laparoscopic space moved around a lot more.
Okay.
So there's one argument saying, they moved around a lot more because they were more comfortable. And then me and along with a few other people, like, well, maybe they couldn't get comfortable, so they kept moving.
Right.
It's like something hurts and you're trying to fall asleep and you're squirming around.
Yeah.
Maybe they're moving around for that reason.
Right.
So what's the answer? I don't know. So it's, even though it's difficult to prove, though, it makes a lot of sense that the smaller the incision, the less pain they're going to feel. Whether it's clinically relevant or not is difficult to say.
Yeah.
I would say the no-brainer, no doubter in my mind, is the thoracoscopic procedure versus a thoracotomy.
Right.
So that means we're putting in little incisions into the chest cavity versus spreading the ribs or doing a sternotomy. That's the the old school heart, heart surgery where you're cracking their chest open.
Right.
That's horrible. Like, I'm a surgeon and it's icky.
Yeah.
So if you can avoid doing those procedures, particularly sternotomies, and you can do it thoracoscopically, huge difference in pain control.
Right.
Huge, yeah. But for a spay where, like, someone like Dr. G has an incision that's maybe 3 inches long,
right,
and then you have a scope port, an instrument port, or two, each are about an inch long.
Right.
I mean, you kind of add them up, and they're about the same.
Right,
right. It's not in the same location.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you're, especially as you're learning and it's taking you 3 hours versus someone like him that takes 3 minutes.
Right.
And you start thinking, well, what's the benefit here? And I have that argument actually with knees. The gold standard, quote unquote, is, scoping your knee for an ACL tear, that sort of thing. I do what's called a little mini medial approach. So it's, it's a couple centimeters long and one incision, deal with it. Whereas if you're scoping, you have multiple entry points. Now they're putting sometimes pins in the femur and the tibia and distracting the joint, so you get a better view of the knee.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you guys, we're getting more and more invasive, and the whole point is to be less invasive, or one of the main points. Some other people would argue, you get a better view of the the knee joint itself, and you do, and certainly can pick up on maybe some meniscal tears that you otherwise would have missed. I get that. But in terms of pure invasiveness, you know, I'd argue it's not that different. And again, I can do it's kind of like the Dr. G Spay analogy. I can do the mini medial in about 5 minutes.
Right.
For $2,000 less versus someone that's scoping all these knees.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, if I had 50% of the coming back with meniscal tears or, you know, problems with the joint, I'd be like, oh, I got to do something different. But
right.
I don't. I mean, they 99% of them do great without any, you know, intra-articular joint issues. So
yeah,
that's my argument for it.
I'll take it. What happens if a wound or incision doesn't heal properly? Does that affect the surgery itself? Can it affect the surgery itself?
Well, anything that isn't, so, you know, surgery is always trauma. You're always, you know, typically always going to make some sort of incision. And if that incision doesn't heal, that's a surgical complication. Absolutely. And there's a whole litany of reasons why something won't heal. The classic and probably the most common, depending on the situation, is infection. So usually we're not healing because of infection issues.
Lack of e-collar use.
So yeah. That's one thing, is absolutely letting them get to the incision, lick, chew, etc., obviously. But also I've learned it's really easy to blame the client and the dog.
Yeah.
There's also some things that you can do that minimizes them wanting to get to that incision. Tissue handling, closing things properly, minimizing bleeding. So these are all called what's called Halstead's. I don't know if you remember from
yes.
school, but Halstead's principles. So, and they, I think it was 20s or 30s or 40s, he came up with them a long time ago. And they still hold true, their basic tenets. And if you, that's going to minimize the chances of issues, because it's going to heal better with those principles intact. And also make it less, the dog less likely to want to lick and chew. Because usually they're licking and chewing because it's bothering them.
Right.
And a lot of people think it's because it's itching.
Yeah.
It could be an itch,
but
usually it's discomfort.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't know what else to do. It's like kind of like if your knee hurts or something, you rub it.
Right.
They can't do that. So they lick and chew, and they just try to self-soothe to some degree.
So it's very important to use those pain medications post-operatively.
Absolutely.
To help them heal.
Yeah.
And then the classic is like, well, I only went to the grocery store for an hour, and
right.
it takes 5 minutes.
Right.
So, you know, and I also hear all the time.
A cat could be 20 seconds.
Yeah, right. And then I always hear he's never done that or she's never done that before. It's
right.
Like, well, yeah, never had a TPLO before.
Right.
Either, probably. And the classic also is chasing squirrel. I'm convinced squirrels know when dogs are recovering from, I swear, I'm not kidding. They know. They can sense that something's off and this dog is slower now and I'm going to mess with them.
I'm going to torment
them.
Because you do the squirrel buzz. The squirrel runs right in front of the dog. And I can tell you hundreds of times, I'm not kidding. People have said, my dog has never chased a squirrel. And 1 week after one of my TPLOs, they totally gunned for a squirrel.
The tormenting squirrel.
I was going to say, you're going to have to write a paper on it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to have to do some real research on it.
There's going to be research on tormenting squirrels pretty soon.
I think there's one that's right outside the podcast studio.
Yeah, so. We'll have to recreate that somehow.
There's one that's been trying to attack Mallory.
Yeah. At first, I was like, oh, maybe I should feed it. Then I was like, wait.
Well, maybe he saw your hair, because I know that's been mistaken
yes,
for a squirrel.
It has. What happens? Let's see. We got another one. What are signs that my pet surgery wasn't successful?
Again,
I guess it depends on the surgery.
Yeah, extremely variable depending on what you're talking about. But we'll talk about, I mean, I guess a classic like spay would be, we can do the whole gamut here. So worst case scenario would be, you know, bleeding internally. So not interactive, lethargic, not wanting to eat.
Gums are not pink.
Gums are white. That's never good.
Right.
You know, a Labrador not wanting to eat is always a very bad sign.
Yeah.
So just kind of general not doing well for sort of an internal surgery, because they may be bleeding. In terms of orthopedics, it would be more local incisional stuff and leg stuff. So swelling, discharge, incisions opening, and then pain. So they're just acting constantly painful. Now, first day or two, maybe not abnormal that something's going wrong. But let's say a week after a knee surgery and they're still miserable amount of pain, there may be something going wrong. And
yeah.
I guess the point would be, and you're probably about to say this, but it's just like, if you're worried that there's something off, no one knows your dog or whatever better than you do. So just ask, because you don't want to assume it's fine. And
you just read my mind.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was our go-to all the time.
Like, when in doubt, call.
Yeah.
immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. It's better to get something at the beginning than wait a couple of days and then it's become a nightmare.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I just thought it was, you know, par for the course. And you're like, No, not at all.
I mean, my biggest challenge is, you know, they call in at 7 or 8 o'clock on a Friday night or whatever. And it's like, oh, my dog just vomited, had knee surgery 2 days ago. You're like, it could be fine. It could be not fine. I mean, we don't know. And so the default, you kind of are stuck with having to say, well, you need to get it checked out because you don't know. And if you say, oh, it'll be fine, you just vomited once, you'd be fine. It may not be.
Right.
And I've had them where, you know.
What if it's bloat?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What if it's bloat? What if they're going to vagal out? What if they're going to, you know, there's a lot of things that could be that are not going to be fine. It usually is fine. But of course, the one time you say, oh, yeah, it's fine, he just vomited once, that's when you're going to get into trouble. So, but the clients are frustrated by that.
Right.
Because, oh, you're just covering your own butt, and I don't want to go to this expensive emergency practice.
Right.
My GP's closed. So that's the pushback you get. And I get it.
I
would do the same thing. But what I try to explain to the clients is, well, from our point of view, what do you want us to do? Say it'll be fine, even though we don't know for sure it will be fine?
Right.
Like, that's what they want.
I mean, it could be the antibiotics they're on. It could be the pain medication they're on.
Exactly.
They could have eaten a sock because they were feeling good.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's so many things it could be.
That's a very hard question to answer.
Yep.
And I'm sure, I mean, I have friends who text me, so I can't even imagine how many texts, emails you guys get, just pictures, right? They're like, is this okay?
Yeah.
And then they're funny.
And you don't even know what it is.
Right.
It's like a zoomed in picture.
Right.
So if you are going to send pictures to us, take a picture out and then slowly zoom it in with each picture.
So, and I'll go, yes. And then the other thing is, and I get this from never you, of course, but veterinarians contact me all the time with a single radiograph saying, what's wrong? And that's it. Like, I don't even know what kind of animal it is.
Is it limping?
Is it coughing? Is it vomiting? It's just like a whole animal radiograph.
Right, it's like a whole lateral shot. They're like, what's wrong?
But
that's important for clients to understand that's why we need to take more than one x-ray.
Right.
And absolutely. And what I was getting at, too, is like, is this okay? My dog is doing great. No signs of limping. Everything is going fine. Or my dog has not used his leg in 2 weeks. I've noticed swelling. I've noticed this. I've noticed discharge, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, give a little bit of history rather than just, and I know it takes a little time and effort, but having a little bit of history for vets and for clients that contact me helps me interpret what I'm seeing much more effectively. And I think the misconception is like, it is what it is. The radiograph is the radiograph. And sometimes, like a broken bone, it's broken bone. I don't need to know the whole life story. It's a broken humerus. But other times, it is more important to kind of have an idea of what's going on to better assess that picture or radiograph that you were sent.
Yeah, and I think to kind of touch back to what you said about how clients always seem to get upset when you're like, well, I think you should go. And everybody, I think the hard part is just wants that quick, immediate answer because it does cost money. It does cost time to go to these specialty clinics.
Totally get it.
But your pets.
I think it's more the time.
Right.
And time and energy and it gets in the way.
Right.
Of everyone. Everyone across the world is grinding every day.
Right. Yep.
Absolutely.
And the money.
Time and money. Right. Absolutely. I get it. Totally.
But I mean, part of, you know, physical exams for animals are the actual physical exam itself, right? And getting vitals from these pets because they're not telling us what's wrong with them. So one thing may not have anything to do with the other, you know?
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've found in the last 5-6 years, it's become exceedingly more difficult for people to find a veterinarian that's willing to just take a look at their animal.
Right.
You know, it just...
COVID was bad.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, the profession has really been hurting post-COVID, because the great resignation, mm-hmm. Just like with nurses and a lot of other professions.
Yeah.
So, as a client, as a pet owner, you have to understand we're doing the best we can with what resources we have.
Right.
And sometimes we can't get that answer instantaneously.
Yeah.
It might take a little bit, but we're working hard to get that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it, too. It's just this is a very fast-paced world that we live in now, right? So everything is instant. Everything, you expect responses immediately. Everybody has their phone on them. So I think you just kind of expect that immediate response.
And our answers will have a little more depth to them than Dr. Google.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
Can a broken bone heal without surgery, or does it always need to be fixed surgically?
It definitely does not need surgery all the time. There's many cases where broken bones do not need surgery at all.
They still need to come in.
Ideally, just right. to get, because most people won't know that.
Right.
The classic would be a single-digit fracture.
Right.
You know, so you do the buddy system just like with us.
The finger.
Yep. Yeah. And because especially if it's a single digit, because you have so much support next to the digit, again, the buddy system, we don't typically tape the digits together, but, you know, we'll put a soft bandage on or a little splint, and those yeah. usually will heal on their own without any issues. Versus, you know, comminuted, i.e. shattered anything, shattered right. any bone, those usually will not heal on their own. Or if they do heal, they'll heal way long time. It'll take a long time to heal and also may not heal properly. So you can have what's called a delayed union or malunion. So delayed or non-union means that it takes too much time to heal or doesn't heal at all. A malunion means it heals, but it's not in a functional sort of position.
So a malunion would be like the bone healing like this instead of straight.
Out of alignment.
Out of alignment. Yep, out of alignment. Yep.